Having discussed the theories in part one, what now are the facts? With others, I firmly believe that free and accepted or speculative masonry had its origin in England. No evidence has yet come to light of any operative organisation capable of going through a transitional stage leading to speculative masonry having existed in England. All the English evidence appears in a non-operative context. The late appearance of two purely operative lodges in England, at Alnwick in Northumberland and Swarwell in County Durham, is a red herring. Their closeness to the Scottish border and method of working indicates Scottish influence rather than the evidence of an indigenous growth. It is singularly unlikely that no record of operative lodges in England have survived, while so many other documents for the same period have come down to us. This lack of evidence has led many Masonic researchers to seize upon the medieval and later usage of the word Freemason, not only as evidence for operative lodges, but also for the existence of speculative masonry in medieval times. However, the word Freemason was a technical term describing a specialist stonemason, one who worked in freestone, usually limestone, capable of being immediately carved for decorative purposes. It has been demonstrated that Freemason in an operative context is a contraction of freestone mason. When the term begins to appear in print, it is clear that it is being used as a technical term describing a particular type of operative mason, since it is generally to be found on the title pages of works devoted to the orders of architecture or architectural design and decoration, compiled for the use of various trades, including freestone masons. There exists a collection of documents which has been called up as evidence both for the operative and non-operative origins of Freemasonry. Described by Anderson as the Gothic Constitutions, and now known collectively as the Old Charges, some 127 versions have been traced, of which 113 are still in existence. All have a common form. A legendary history of the Mason craft, tracing it from biblical origins to its establishment in England. A code of regulations for masters, fellows, and apprentices, covering both craft practices and morals. And admission procedures for new men that were never charged before, including an oath of fidelity. It has been established that the documents are of English origin. The few versions with a completely Scottish provenance are later copies of the English originals. Historically, the old charges fall into three groups. The first comprises the two earliest versions, the Regius manuscript of about 1390 and the Cook manuscript of about 1420. The second and largest group begins with the Grand Lodge No. 1 manuscript, dated 25th of December 1583, and covers all the versions datable before the formation of the Premier Grand Lodge in 1717. The third group comprises manuscript and printed versions produced after 1717, the majority of which appear to have been produced as antiquarian curiosities. Of the three historical groups, the second is the most important and raises a number of interesting questions. Unless a number of 15th and 16th century versions have been lost or have not yet been discovered, why should a new version appear in 1583, which has little similarity to the Regius manuscript and more differences than similarities to the Cook manuscript? If the two earliest versions had some trade or guild connection, why should there have been such a revival in their production after 1583, when the guild system was virtually extinct and no operative lodges existed? If, as has been claimed, the manuscripts were prepared for operative lodges, why have these documents survived and not others that might provide evidence of operative lodges? These questions have led one researcher to propose the theory that the post-1583 versions of the old charges were not produced for operative purposes, but are the first evidence of non-operative Freemasonry. Internal evidence from the old charges shows them to have been used at the making of Masons. Other evidence shows them to have been used at the making of accepted masons. They clearly had an importance for the early members of the Premier Grand Lodge, for copies are known to have been produced at early meetings of the Grand Lodge, and Anderson digested them when preparing the 1723 constitutions. The actual charges were certainly important, for Anderson codified them to form the ancient charges with which he prefaced the Grand Lodge regulations in the 1723 constitutions. These ancient charges have prefaced the Book of Constitutions ever since. The earliest record of the making of an English accepted mason is that of Elias Ashmole, founder of Oxford's Ashmolean Museum. He recorded his making in his diary as follows.
In October 1646, at 4:30 in the afternoon, I was made a Freemason at Warrington in Lancashire, with Colonel Henry Mannering of Carincham in Cheshire. The names of those that were of the lodge were Mr. Richard Penkett Warden, Mr. James Collier, Mr. Richard Sankey, Henry Littler, John Ellum, Richard Ellum, and Hugh Brewer.
Obviously, Ashmole and Mannering, his father-in-law, were not the first Freemasons. The seven who formed the lodge must have been made at some stage. What is important about the lodge is that, with one possible exception, none of those who formed it had any connection with the operative mason's craft. Much research has gone into tracing Ashmole's lodge, both in trying to identify those present and to trace other records of its activities. Such evidence as we have points not to the existence of continuing lodgers holding regular meetings, but to what have become termed occasional lodgers. That is, the calling together of sufficient masons to hold a lodge for the purpose of making a new mason, the lodge existing only as long as the occasion for which it was called. The only other references to Freemasonry in Ashmole's diary come some 36 years after his making, when, in 1682, he was summoned to attend a lodge meeting at the Masons Company Hall in London. Mention of Masons Hall brings us to a consideration of the London Masons Company. Now one of the livery companies of the City of London, the Masons Company had its origins as the operative Masons Guild controlling the London trade. In this, it had a purely operative function, with no speculative connotation whatsoever. In the 17th century, however, it had within it a curious phenomenon now known as the exception. An accounts book, begun on the 1st of July 1619, has some interesting entries upon which much has been built. An entry for 1621 begins, "At the making of masons," and at first sight would appear to be an entry concerning the registering of liverymen of the company. The fees recorded as being paid for these makings were in excess of those paid for the livery, and three of those recorded as having paid them had already paid their livery fees the previous year. Many of the later entries also show persons paying for their making who had previously paid the livery fine. Others paid for making and had no connection whatsoever with the livery. It would seem, therefore, that the making of masons was something completely separate from the trade function of the Masons Company, and that the exception was an inner circle within the company. There is also reference to what was possibly a version of the old charges, and to a framed parchment listing all those who had been accepted. Both items are unfortunately now lost. Ashmole's initiation had been preceded by what is, so far, the earliest printed reference to the mason word. Adamson's The Muses Threnody had been published in Edinburgh in 1638, and on folio 32 the following couplet appears.
"For we be brethren of the Rosy Cross, we have the mason word and second sight."
Adamson being a Scot, it can be argued that what he is referring to is the Scottish operative mason and his secret modes of recognition, rather than to non-operative or accepted masonry. A similar reference to the Mason word appeared in England in 1672 in Marvell's The Rehearsal Transposed, in which one character states, "And as those that have the Mason word secretly discern one another." Again, it is arguable whether Marvell was referring to Scottish operative practice or had knowledge of the existence of accepted masonry in England. Randall Holme III provides us with information of a lodge meeting in Chester. Holme, in his Academy of Armoury in 1688, writes, "I cannot but honour the fellowship of the Masons because of its antiquity, and the more as being myself a member of that society called Freemasons." It is argued that here Holme is dealing with two separate organisations, the Fellowship of Masons, that is, the operative trade-governing guild, and the Society of Freemasons, of which he and other non-operatives were members. In the British Library is what is now known as the Harleian Manuscript, number 2054, of the Old Charges, written out by Holme about 1650. Preserved with it are two important scraps of paper, again in Holme's hand. The first contains the earliest trace reference to signs and words.
"There is several words and signs of a Freemason to be revealed to you, which, as you will answer, before God at the great and terrible day of judgment, you keep secret, and not to reveal the same to any in the hearing of any person whatsoever, but to the master and fellows of the said Society of Freemasons. So help me God."
Note the reference at the beginning and end to Freemasons. The second scrap is a list of 26 names, including Randall Holme, against which certain sums of money are set. Much investigation has been done into the names, leading to the belief that the list is of members of Holme's lodge about 1672. Apart from the Old Charges, fragment of obligation and list of members, no other records of the lodge at Chester appear to have survived. That accepted masonry was sufficiently known to the public by 1676 is shown by a lampooning advertisement printed in that year. Poor Robin's Intelligence was a scurrilous sheet printed in 1676 and 77, which included a series of facetious advertisements. One ran,
"These are to give notice that the modern green-ribboned cabal, together with the ancient Brotherhood of the Rosy Cross, the Hermetic Adepti, and the Company of Accepted Masons, intend all to dine together on the 31st of November next, at the Flying Bull in Windmill Crown Street."
Dr. Robert Plott, though not himself a Freemason, claimed in his Natural History of Staffordshire in 1686 that accepted masonry was widespread. He states,
"To these add the customs relating to the county, whereof they have one, of admitting men into the Society of Freemasons, that in the moorlands of the county seems to be of greater request than anywhere else, though I find the custom spread more or less all over the nation. For here I found persons of the most eminent quality that did not disdain to be of this fellowship."
Plott, unfortunately, was both gullible and prone to exaggeration. His work, however, is important in that it gives us the earliest traced indication of what was involved at a making, when he states,
"Into which society, when they are admitted, they call a meeting, or lodge as they term it in some places, which must consist at least of five or six of the ancients of the order, whom the candidates present with gloves, and so likewise to their wives, and entertain with a collation, according to the custom of the plan. This ended, they proceed to the administration of them, which chiefly consists in the communication of certain secret signs, whereby they are known to one another all over the nation, by which means they have maintenance whither ever they travel."
The diarist John Aubrey, a contemporary of Plott, published his Natural History of Wiltshire in 1686. The manuscript is now in the Bodleian Library, and on folio 73 he writes,
"Sir William Dugdale told me many years since that about Henry III's time, the Pope gave a bull or diploma to a company of Italian architects to travel up and down all over Europe to build churches. From those are derived the fraternity of adopted Masons. They are known to one another by certain signs and marks and watchwords. It continues to this day. They have several lodges in several counties for their reception, and when any of them fall into decay, the Brotherhood is to relieve him. The manner of their adoption is very formal, and with an oath of secrecy.
This passage confirms what Plot had stated in more extravagant terms, that Freemasonry was known in several counties. The manuscript of Aubrey's Natural History of Wiltshire has an addendum, which has added confusion to an already muddled subject, the question of whether or not Sir Christopher Wren was an accepted or Freemason.
18th May 1691. This day, being Monday after Rogation Sunday, is a great convention at St. Paul's Church of the Fraternity of the Accepted Masons, where Sir Christopher Wren is to be adopted a brother, and Sir Henry Goodry of the Tower, and divers others. There have been kings that have been of this sodality.
Aubrey's is the only record of the great convention. The addendum is certainly in his hand, and there would seem to be no reason for his having invented the incident. Sir Christopher Wren is treated rather curiously in the 1723 and 1738 editions of the Constitutions. In the first, he is mentioned only twice, as the ingenious architect Sir Christopher Wren, and in a footnote as the architect of the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford. By the 1738 edition, this has all changed. Now Anderson states that Wren was a member of the craft, had been Grand Warden, Deputy Grand Master, and Grand Master. This raises two problems. First, there is a conflict between Aubrey and Anderson, the former stating Wren was accepted in 1691, the latter claiming he had been Grand Warden in 1663, some 28 years earlier. The second problem is why Anderson only mentions Wren in passing in 1723, but by 1738, Wren having died in 1723, has remembered such an exact catalogue of his high ranks. The only conclusion we can draw is that Anderson needed a major figure to bolster his claim that the formation of Grand Lodge in 1717 was a revival. The best that can be said of Wren's connection with Freemasonry is that it is not proven. From the early 1690s onwards, we begin to get more evidence of non-operative lodges. The York No. 4 manuscript of the Old Charges was written in 1693 by one Mark Kipling and ends with a list of lodge members. Anderson, in the second edition of the Constitutions, in a paragraph dealing with the year 1693, claimed that at least 8 lodges were working in London. What is interesting is Anderson's differentiation between an occasional and a stated lodge, the latter being the first implication of lodges meeting on a regular and continuous basis. Freemasonry appears to have been well enough known in London by 1698 to warrant the publication of an anti-Masonic leaflet.
To all godly people in the city of London, having thought it needful to warn you of the mischiefs and evils practised in the sight of God by those called Freemasons, I say, take care lest their ceremonies and secret swearings take hold of you, and be wary that none cause you to err from godliness. For this devilish sect of men are meeters in secret, which swear against all without their following. They are the Antichrist, which was to come, leading men from their fear of God. For how should men meet in secret places and with secret signs, taking care that none observe them to do the work of God? Are not these the ways of evildoers? Knowing how that God observeth privily them that sit in darkness, they shall be smitten, and the secrets of their hearts laid bare. Mingle not among this corrupt people, lest you be found so at the world's conflagration.
Another version of the Old Charges, the Scarborough manuscript, has an endorsement of 1705 as follows.
Memorandum. that at a private lodge held at Scarborough in the county of York, the 10th day of July 1705, before William Thompson, Esquire, president of the said lodge, and several others, brethren Freemasons, the several persons whose names are hereunto subscribed, were then admitted into the said fraternity. Edward Thompson, John Tempest, Robert Johnson, Thomas Lister, Samuel Buck, and Richard Hudson.
In the same year, 1705, more evidence comes from Yorkshire, the records of a non-operative lodge in York, which later became the Grand Lodge of all England. The earliest records of this York lodge are known only from a letter of the 29th of August 1778 from Brother Jacob Bussey, stating, "I have inspected an original minute book of this Grand Lodge, beginning at 1705 and ending in 1734, from which I have extracted the names of the Grand Masters during that period." There is still in existence a parchment roll, York Roll No. 7, labelled "A Parchment Roll Containing the Manual Subscriptions, etc. of Persons Made Masons in the Grand Lodge." Begun on the 19th of March 1712, the roll contains minutes of meetings and signatures of members down to 1730. The minutes included in the roll give a few clues as to what occurred in the lodge. Only one ceremony appears to have been used, in which the candidate was admitted and sworn into the Ancient and Honourable Society and Fraternity of Freemasons. The lodge is referred to variously as the Society and Fraternity of Freemasons, the Company of Freemasons, and the Society of Free and Accepted Masons. From the names of the presiding officers and some of the candidates, as well as the evidence of the minutes, it is clear that the York Lodge was not an operative lodge, but one of accepted masons. Among the membership were two peers, three baronets, eight esquires, and 15 gentlemen. Meetings of the York Lodge don't appear to have been confined to York itself. In 1713, it held an occasional lodge in Bradford, at which 18 gentlemen of the first families in that neighbourhood were made masons. George Grey of Southwich recorded in his diary, 1710, February 20, I was made a Freemason at Beedale, which may have been a meeting of an occasional lodge or a visit by members of the York Lodge. Public references to Freemasons' modes of recognition appear in the Tatler in 1709 and 1710. In number 26 for the 7th to the 9th of June 1709, the following appears.
They have their signs and tokens like Freemasons.
The subject was referred to again in issue number 166 for 29th of April to 2nd of May 1710.
You may see them at first sight grow acquainted by sympathy, insomuch that one who had not studied nature and did not know the true cause of their sudden familiarities would think that they had some secret intimation of each other, like the Freemasons.
Claims that many lodges sprang up in London, operative in character, as a result of the need to rebuild the city after the Great Fire of 1666, are not substantiated by hard evidence. We have Anderson's statement that there were at least eight lodges in London in 1693, but with the possible exception of the Old Lodge at St. Paul's, we have no other evidence for them. What we do know is that there were certainly four lodges in existence in London in 1717, the four which came together to form the Grand Lodge. They were the Lodge at the Goose and Gridiron, St. Paul's Churchyard, now the Lodge of Antiquity No. 2. Described as a time immemorial lodge, it is believed to be Anderson's Old Lodge at St. Paul's of 1693. According to the engraved list of lodges for 1729, it came into existence in 1691. The Lodge at the Crown, Parker's Lane, Lincoln's Inn Field, which went out of existence in 1736. According to the engraved list of lodges for 1729, it came into existence in 1712. The Lodge at the Rummer and Grapes, Channel Row, Westminster, now the Royal Somerset House and Inverness Lodge No. 4, with time immemorial status. Its date of origin is not known. The lodge at the Apple Tree Tavern, Charles Street, Covent Garden, now the Lodge of Fortitude and Old Cumberland No. 12, with time immemorial status. Its date of origin is not known either. Whilst we have no indication as to their membership or work, as no early records of these four lodges have survived, the Grand Lodge which they founded still exists today. And that is the next part of our story.